RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Sarah Wigglesworth has carved out a unique place for herself in the male-dominated arena of architecture. Along with her longtime partner, Jeremy Till, she has trailblazed the use of alternative materials, sustainability, and green technology. Her very first project, the Straw Bale House, both her home and office, caused quite a stir in the architecture world, winning an RIBA award, and 13 years on, students still regularly flock to the building. In addition to receiving an MBE for her services to architecture, she was made a Royal Designer for Industry in 2012. But with success comes personal sacrifice. In this revealing interview, Sarah talks about her early life, women in architecture, her strong views on so-called iconic buildings, and much more. I spoke to Sarah at her home and practice in North London. So we're sitting in the building that was your first, really your first major project.
That's right, yeah.
And that was some 12 years ago, more or less?
Well, we started designing it about 15 years ago, yeah. Actually. But yes, it's coming up to its 13th birthday.
So I mean, the building's still standing. And you obviously learned an awful lot, because I did see that original program where you were literally having to solve problems on the go, you know, because you were putting your theories and your money into practice. So has it performed as well as you'd hoped, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, big question. Well, like all, the answer to all these questions is sort of a bit of both, really. I think that what we did with this building is sort of demonstrates that it is possible to do some amazing things with some sites. And actually, on the whole, what stops you doing that is time, money, energy, and just kind of, you know, you need an enormous amount of persistence to do it. In fact, I think persistence is one of the greatest qualities of an architect, actually, because getting through the regulatory system and so forth is really quite tough. So having achieved it and living in a place that you've designed and you love has been absolutely fantastic. And, I mean, I can't recommend that highly enough to anybody who is contemplating, you know, making the world around them the way they would like it to be. So don't give up is my message. So, I mean, and I've loved living here. It's absolutely fantastic. I think where it hasn't performed as well as we might have hoped is that, like many green buildings, they're very flawed when you come to realise them. In other words, you know, you need very good build quality. And, I mean, in a way, a lot of predictions are based on, you know, calculations of how you expect them to work. And they never work quite exactly as you really hope. So, actually, I think that's been a bit of a disappointment for us. But then on the other hand, I think we've done all sorts of other things, like move the aesthetic of green buildings forward quite a bit. I think we've really planted on the architectural stage the idea that the material cycle doesn't just end at the end of a building, you know, that you've still got to do something with your waste, and that waste management and reincorporating waste products is incredibly important. And I think that's becoming much, much more mainstream now. So I do feel quite proud for having introduced quite a lot of ideas like that in what is becoming much more mainstream now.
And I mean, your ideas went very much before this building started, because you were giving a lot of, I think at the time, a lot of talks about sustainability and ecology and alternative materials particularly.
Well, really, yeah. I mean, the ideas, a lot of people have asked us, where did the ideas for this building come from? And actually, they really are a sedimentation of a lot of thinking that went on a long time ago now, 20 years ago now. And they grew out of a lot of different areas of exploration, some of which were to do with, I mean, my partner and I got a Fulbright fellowship to study in America for 9 months. Mm. And like often happens when you're plucked out of your natural environment, so to speak, and you're somewhere else and you see your world through new eyes from a distance, you suddenly realize all sorts of things about what's going on, and you put them into perspective through being somewhere else. And I think America, with its enormous sort of profligacy, really woke us up to the idea that a petrochemical economy and an economy based on constant consumption and waste and masses of waste was really not very good, and that actually as architects we needed to take some responsibility for that and think up some new strategy. So this was all sort of brewing around in 1991 when we were away, and when we came back and we were teaching in schools of architecture in London, you know, that was just the beginning of thinking about sustainability and what that might mean for an architecture. And then there were concerns about people and the presence of people and the importance of people at the centre of architecture, which I think modernism had very much erased, actually. So there was a re-evaluation about all of those things, and somehow it all kind of condensed around our buying this site and having a plaything to exercise a lot of these ideas around. And, you know, then it was overlaid with other issues like, I'm very critical of the cult of the expert, and that had come out of actually my personal position as a young architect being trying to sort of establish a credibility within the field of architecture, and also being female, because I think it's more difficult to establish credibility as a female. And so one of the things we were interested here is actually denying the cult of the expert and trying to make a project which is about self-building. In other words, to empower people that actually they could take control over their lives. And so a lot of the techniques that we were beginning to develop were about trying to build very simply without the necessity to go to experts and find out very difficult things and employ people at enormous cost and so forth. And so that's how we developed ideas around straw bales and using recycled products in gabion walls. I mean, big just cages that you fill rocks with, and you Bob's your uncle, you've got a wall. So there's a lot of stuff like that going on as well. So there are all these sort of strands around this agenda of empowerment and communities and self-build and simplicity and undermining all sorts of architectural conventions and la la la. And I don't know, somehow they're just all condensed in this project.
Let's turn the clock back a bit go back to a young Sarah. So tell me about your childhood. Where you were born in North London, I think.
I was born in...
probably not far from here.
Yeah, very close to here, about a mile and a half away in the maternity hospital, Liverpool Road in Islington. And my parents had moved to Islington after the war, and they were sort of early gentrifiers, really. And they'd come to Islington because my dad worked for Maxwell Fry as a young architect. He was an architect as well.
In the family.
And Max's daughter had a house in Allwyn Road, and he lodged with her in the early days, and so they looked around for somewhere to live around here. My mother was a doctor, and she she gave up work to look after her kids, but went back to work for St Thomas's, and she was a consultant paediatrician at the end of her career. So they were, you know, they moved back to Islington. They're both from London, and they moved back to London, and I was brought up here, and I went to Camden School for Girls down the road. So I just had a very normal
brothers, you know, sisters.
I had two sisters. Yeah, I mean, I'm in the middle.
And what do they do? What do yours?
One is a mother and has just set up a business in horticultural design, and the other one studied a whole range of things, from photography to law, and is a legal librarian. But she's actually reinvented herself recently after being made redundant, and she's now teaching English to people where English is a second language.
So presumably your interest in architecture was very much in the family. I mean,
it was in the family.
So was that the kind of catalyst for you? Did you have other desires or possibilities as a young, you know,
that's really interesting. Well, I've always loved drawing, and I've been always quite good at drawing, and I always used to love making things. I don't actually remember my father being an enormous influence on me. I mean, I don't think he certainly didn't try and persuade me to become an architect. In fact, if anything, he tried to put me off. But I mean, my dad was basically was a public servant. He was at the ILEA and the GLC, and he was a manager and administrator. But one of my earliest memories was of him coming back from work with these blue dye lines, and he used to cut these pages up, and we would draw on the back of them, and we were always drawing at home. And I remember turning these pages over and looking at these blueprints and thinking, Oh, I get it. I see what's going on. And I never had a problem reading these drawings at all. And I was always a bit fascinated by what they represented and so forth. So, I mean, and then in a way, I think I formulated an idea that I might be a good architect or might become an architect really early on. I mean, you know, age 7 or something, really stupid, even though I didn't really know anything about it at all. But at school, I was an all-rounder. You know, I was good at languages, I was good at maths and science, and I was good at geography and stuff. I didn't really like history, and I didn't really like English, and I didn't get the arts at all, really. And I was thinking of studying physics or something. And at A levels, I did 2 maths and physics.
Right.
And then I thought, well, I'll do art because I like to do it anyway. And so I did it sort of in my spare time. And I did take the A level in the end, although I didn't get a very good grade for it. But it was just nice to keep going. And it was sort of an antidote to all the science I was doing. But I was really, really into science big time, and I nearly did science. But actually, I'm really glad that I didn't now. And I don't really know what crystallised it all, but I think I just decided I'm going to go for it and see if I can do architecture.
And you went to Cambridge University.
I went to Cambridge, yeah. I got into Cambridge, which is extraordinary, really. I don't really know how I did that.
And you graduated with a distinction.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you're in the real architecture world. How was that, the transition from university to reality?
Oh, it was really difficult. I don't think my training gave us any expectation of what working life was like. But I had a very bad reaction to Cambridge. I mean, I didn't enjoy my time there very much. And I always felt that the course was overtly designed for, you know, to kind of develop the leaders of private practice in the future. And I didn't think that it gave you any grounding in the reality of what practice might ask you to address. So it was entirely design focused. It was mainly based around Cambridge projects, so nothing very big, as you can imagine. And I mean, I actually had a very bad reaction to that. And when I came to London, I went to work for a firm called Levitt Bernstein, who do a lot of housing association work. In other words, it was completely the opposite end. It was very everyday world. It was, you know, trying to make a bit better the kind of background to most people's lives. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the art galleries and all the things that we were being asked to design in the School of Architecture. And I thought, suddenly I thought, I can see how architecture can connect with something really useful for people's lives and try and make the kind of background world a bit better. So it was actually very unglamorous work, but I really enjoyed it, and the people there were fantastic, and I had a great time. And suddenly I thought I could sort of see a way through. And then, and actually that was my, we in the course we have, it's 3 years for a degree, and then you go out for a year, and then you go back to college for 2 years, and then you do a final year, and then you qualify. And I went to Levitt Bernstein in that gap year. And then I decided not to go back to college straight away because I hadn't been very happy in Cambridge. And I thought I might look around for another place to study. But in the meanwhile, I decided I needed another year off because I couldn't bear the idea of going back to college straight away. So I went off to America and I worked in Atlanta, Georgia, which was quite weird.
Doing what?
Being an architect. And then I went traveling, I went to South America, and you know, I just kind of needed to get away.
So you got yourself a job in an architectural firm?
Yeah,
over
exactly
there. And how was that?
It was completely different, very, very money focused, but in a way it gave me lots of freedom and confidence to sort of do all kinds of things. And also just sort of put the whole Cambridge thing in a lot of perspective, because I think just to get away and see how a bunch of people do things and think is terribly useful for just getting it in a context. And you know, then you don't just see it as this little bubble, which is the entire world, which is the way they sort of seem to operate there. So I mean, I think that was very, very good for me, and I came back much more confident individual. And actually I decided to go back to Cambridge on the basis that the devil you know is better than the one you don't. And anyway, by that stage all the teachers had changed, and it was a great time. But I mean, subsequently, I went, you know, I never wanted to work for anybody well known. And when I left college, I went into a very small, modest practice and just learnt the ropes. And quite quickly, I sort of went out on my own. And really, that was just the arrogance of youth, not knowing at all what I was doing. It was a crazy thing to do. I should never have done it.
And that was with your long-term partner? Or
no,
or
that was with somebody else I'd been at college with, who I'm now no longer... I mean, I was in partnership with them in the early days, but I'm no longer in partnership. I run my own practice on my own. In a way, I think I was never going to fit in very easily. I mean, personality-wise, and also the way I just saw myself, I didn't see myself sort of reflected in any other practice. I just couldn't imagine myself being in the practices I was in for any length of time. It was something to do with culture and ethos and identity and all those weird things.
Mm.
And I just thought, actually, I'd probably be better off on my own. Mm. And I don't regret that at all, but it has been a really long, slow, hard
ride. I'll come to that issue that I'm sure you've been asked about many, many times, and that's the ratio of male to female architects. I mean, it's about, I think, 20% or less than 20%.
I think it's 18% or something.
Whereas actually during the training process, it's more like 40 women to 60.
Indeed.
And so there's a massive dropout of women. Why do you think that is?
I think there's never one easy answer to these things. I think it's a myriad of different reasons which all sort of conspire together to make it quite hard. I think at a base level, it's a very long hours culture. You know, right from the word go in your training, there's a sort of macho thing about you putting in hours. So all nighters are really common, and you know, you're never finished until the drawing is literally pulled out of your hand. So there's that. So it demands incredible stamina and dedication. It's a very long training, and it's a very tough training because the basis of the work is that you learn through doing. You know, you're not told how to design. You learn to design through doing it. So that's one of the reasons it's long and grueling. But another plank of it is that you put your work up for scrutiny through what's called the criticism system. And there you stand up and you defend your work in front of people. And a lot of women who aren't confident and are sort of put in public like that find all that quite hard. Now, having said all that, they do get through the education system. But I mean, I think once you get into the world of, you know, practice, suddenly architecture is part of the building world. And the building world is about 98% male, and it's very aggressive. It's a very macho culture, and you are almost entirely working with men on the building side. And in fact, I think the statistics show that the biggest drop-off of women in our profession is around the time they run their first project on site. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's got a huge factor to do with it. I mean, you know, women on the whole, I mean, I don't really buy these massive generalizations, but I mean, on the whole, we're socialized to be very compliant and we're not socialized to be aggressive. And actually, you need to be aggressive in our world. So a lot of people feel very uncomfortable with that. And I'm actually very in favor of a kind of feminization of our world, because I think it would make the world a lot nicer place. But trying to crack that nut in, you know, construction is very, very hard. I think the other thing is that although architectural practices are generally male, I mean, you know, can imagine that's the truth with 18% women. And I think despite our quite liberal outlook and we're creatives and all the rest of it, actually, I think there are a lot of very entrenched and not very recognised sexist behaviours patterns in architectural practices. So that, you know, for example, you know, women don't put themselves forward or promote themselves enough when in salaries, and our salaries are very, very low. So, you know, if you're going to have any freedom for getting childcare or to just promote yourself and, you know, earn a decent living so you can support yourself, you've got to be quite pushy. And there are, you know, not very good family friendly and flexible work patterns. And it's very true that if you're running a job on site, it's absolutely demanding. So it's not a job you can easily do part time. So you might find you're dismissed and not able to get the kind of chances that your male counterparts do because of the kind of pressures of the workload. You know, so there are lots and lots of aspects of it which I think make it very hard for women. And I, you know, I completely understand why women do leave the profession. And I, when I set up my practice, which was when I was sort of in my mid-30s, early 30s, you know, I decided not to have children because I wanted to run my practice. And yeah. Actually, that was a really stark decision I had to make.
And is that the case still? You have no children?
I have no children.
Well, that's a remarkable sacrifice, I have to say.
Well, I have to put it in context. I'm not that interested in children. I'm much more interested in my work. And I was very worried that if I did have kids, I might get very resentful. Yes, and I didn't think that was a good position to be in. I mean, my partner's not that keen on kids either. So I think we didn't feel that it was a massive privation. Right. I don't really regret it. But I think, you know, there's a lot of pressure on women to sort of show that they can have it all. And actually, you can't have it all. Yes. And I think I was quite black and white about that, so that was a decision I made.
You're currently professor of architecture at Sheffield University.
I haven't mentioned that side at all.
Well, I'm interested to know, you know, with your obviously very intimate knowledge of the world that you inhabit as a female architect, what you actually say to your female students. The male students can look after themselves, but in terms of this specific area, because it clearly is a tricky one. And I know from, you know, the design world that I come from, the fallout of female is high for the very reason that you said. The moment, you know, that marriage comes along and children come, it all changes. You know, it's a dramatic change. And, you know, the infrastructure is not there to support in the design industry, it seems to me. So what do you say to your young students when they come up to say, you know, Sarah, you know, you've made a name for yourself. How do you do it? Mm.
Well, I'm very, very honest about it. I mean, I think there's actually a lot of denial that goes on in our industry about the difficulties that a lot of women face. And I think that's partly because there's a desperate desire, understandably, to get women into the profession. And I think a lot of people see it as a numbers game because, you know, the more women you get, the more it'll change the culture. But, I mean, that's not really going to happen if, you know, you still get these drop-off rates. In other words, there's something more structural about it that we need to address. Although there are obviously the issues around childcare and flexible working and all the rest of it, actually, I'm personally much more interested in the issues around the culture that we create within the built environment professions and how we need to actually really rethink our relationship with the built environment through that and the way that we collaborate and work together and stop it being quite so adversarial, quite so legalistic, quite so blame-centred and all the rest of it. Because if we could get a more collaborative, i.e. female way of doing things, then I think we could really begin to change things and actually in the process make the built environment better as a result and more people-centred, which I think it should be.
Actually, that's a very interesting point because I wanted to move on to, you know, the core of your philosophy, if you like, of architecture. And there are a couple of people who I'm sure you know of. They may be a little bit out of fashion now, but there was an architectural commentator and critic called Stuart Brand, who's still alive, and he was responsible many years ago for the Whole Earth Catalogue, if you remember. He's a very alternative thinker. But he wrote a book, a rather scathing book, actually, called How Buildings Learn. And it was principally about if a building is built by an architect and it doesn't work for the people that use it, ultimately they will make it work by changing things, even, you know, to their detriment. And he used Florence as a good example of layers of change, you know, just universal change. And that led me on to also his thoughts seem to segue very nicely into another architectural theorist called Christopher Alexander, who wrote a series of books, one of which is one of my favourite books, which is The Timeless Way of Building, which is a beautiful book. And it seems to me it's all centred around if you like, this idea that people, that centering on people and how people use building is one of the most important things. And it would seem to me that, you know, we live in an age where many architects of note are not necessarily thinking about the people using the building on an intimate sort of level, only on a practical level. They're more about monument building. So I just wanted to, it struck me, looking at your body of work, which I think you've done something like 13 schools.
We've done quite a few schools, yeah.
Counted up 11 schools and two. No, but a lot. You built quite a few, and that must be an interesting area. I mean, only this week I just happened to hear a quick interview with Zaha Hadid, who's just done her first school and has said she would like to do more schools. You've done a lot, and looking at them, they do have a lovely quality to them. So I'd be interested to know how, for example, with the school, how you approach that. Because schools obviously usually have very tight budgets, and, you know, so how do you... I suppose what I'm trying to understand is what is the most important thing to you in taking on a project?
Yeah, okay. Well, I think ultimately I'm quite a kind of old-fashioned architect. I'm really just interested in beautiful space because I think that's really uplifting and inspiring. But it has to be practical and it has to be in conversation with its setting, you know, its environment around it. And it has to say something about the people who occupy it, particularly in a school. I mean, okay, of course, in the long term, it could be converted into something else. We've all seen board schools converted into housing and all the rest of it. But in a way, a good building should outlast that, I think, really. So in a way, I think I think at the base level, I think architecture speaks through the languages of light, space, material, and the kind of, I suppose, the sort of aesthetic representation of all of that as it comes together. So good architecture makes you feel good and makes you want to go there and enjoy being there. I think it's a very bodily experience. I think it's very sensory and tactile. And I think a lot of architecture being very mechanized, actually, because a lot of our production techniques are highly mechanized, are often not very sensory, actually. They're visually very beautiful. I mean, they're designed for the photograph, you know, but they're not actually there to kind of make your bodily responses, really. I mean, visceral responses work. And I'm really interested in that aspect of it. I think it's very overlooked in architecture, mainly because, of course, we talk, you know, we communicate our ideas through 2D visuals. So, I mean, those are really just the key things. And I mean, I think when we're designing a project and we're always interested, I mean, and it's very, very straightforward. Everybody's interested in it, really. It's sight. It's about the people, massively about the people and what they're trying to achieve and how you're giving life to that. And it's about the sort of particular historic kind of issues around their organisation. And in a school, I think that's very important because every school has a different kind of characteristic. You know, they're interested in a learning regime of a particular kind. They're, you know, reading might be at the heart of what they're trying to do. And so you're trying to give life through that idea, or it might be that they want to run their school in a particular way, or they have a very specific teaching manner. I mean, they might want to join classes together or take people off into little groups and so on. And obviously all the spatial relationships have to relate to their idea about how they're going to teach. So, I mean, in a way, it's all very obvious, but I think what we try and do is sort of put these... Well, we put the people right at the heart of the process, and with school, and actually with most buildings, it's absolutely essential to use your stakeholder group, you know, your clients, your school body, the teachers, the head, into the mix and collaborate with them to try and give life to their organisation. Where we as a practice find it very, very difficult to work is when we don't have a client, like mass housing schemes or, I mean, my idea of a nightmare would be to design a kind of spec office because, there's nobody there to work with.
I really wanted to mention that because you just touched on a lot of these large architecture projects are seen in photographs. And in fact, Stuart Brand
sort of categorised different versions, and he referred to what he called magazine architecture.
Yeah.
And I, thinking about that, I thought to myself, well, you know, we are living in a kind of period of, and we have done for the last 20 odd years, of kind of what one would call statement architects. So if you look at the London skyline at the moment, there are three particular examples of buildings that I would put in that category. We've got the Gherkin, of course, we've got now the Shard, and soon we'll have the Cheese Grater. Those three buildings are all kind of vying with one another, like mine's bigger than yours, and big atriums, and making people feel about, you know, a metre high in these big, impressive buildings that have big, impressive organisations. And I've heard this week that Frank Gehry is in town publicising a project that he's going to do at the Battersea Power Station. So it'd be interesting to know what's going to happen there. One could almost envision it, what it's going to be now. But it seems to me that those sort of buildings, although, you know, they make a kind of a graphic statement to the skyline, they're rather soulless. I mean, you go into them and it's a big void. You're immediately intimidated by the sheer space that's seemingly wasted just to say you've arrived at this big building. What would you do if a property, you know, tycoon came along and said, okay, we'd like you to build one of these buildings? How would you?
I don't know what I'd do.
How would you cope?
I sometimes wonder, actually, because I wouldn't even know where to start. I mean, you know, there is an aspect of architecture, and it's of the type that you've generally described. I mean, they're what's called iconic projects,
yes.
And they tend to be very prominent, high status, in extremely high land value places where people are obviously trying to make a lot of money. And, you know, and the status aspect of architecture, I think, is incredibly powerful. So, you know, it goes anything from the Guggenheim, something like that, you know, through these massive office blocks and the walkie-talkie that's going up at the moment in the City of London. And actually, I mean, that kind of architecture just doesn't really interest me. I can't see the point of it, really. I mean, it will go on, obviously, and because it makes a lot of money for people, and it's about Britain playing this part of being, you know, global financial capital and so on, but I absolutely don't know what I would do, and I'm not very interested, I'm not at all interested in architecture as sculpture. I mean, people like Frank or Zaha, I mean, they're really interested in architecture being generated by computer programs, and I'm not interested in that at all, not at all. I mean, I can't see how that really adds to some benefit of humanity in any way. I mean, all you're doing is really just crunching data and coming up with kind of squiggles or whatever it might be. And in the end, I really can't see how that helps anything particularly.
I was told that there's a building that's gone up. I've forgotten what it's called, but it sort of does the opposite to the Shard. It actually splays out towards the top.
That's the walkie-talkie.
Is that the walkie-talkie?
Yes.
Well, I'm told it's like that because the floor plates, as they get to the top and get wider, are much more expensive, and you get much higher rentals.
Yeah.
Is that the way
it works? Form follows finance, really. Yeah.
I think it's looking at London's kind of particularly, they've tried every conceivable shape now.
Yeah.
And running out of shapes to compete with one another. And
yeah.
I mean, so when you're not designing, and you're obviously very busy, well, what sort of things are you doing now? What are you working on at the moment?
Okay, well, we're doing housing. We're designing housing in Cambridge for Cambridge University, big new development they're building in the northwest of the city.
Oh, that's a kind of interesting sort of...
It is. It's very, very interesting.
In terms that you went to Cambridge.
Yes.
And you said that all the projects there were not particularly very interesting at the time.
Well, it's an everyday world. You know, we're designing key worker housing, which means for early stage researchers in a massive new master plan for this entire new development out there. But it's fun. We're collaborating with two other architects, and that's good fun because it gets you into different conversations and sort of raises the design stakes. And although, you know, I said it's difficult working on a project where you don't have a user group. Well, we don't know exactly who's going to go in there. We've only got a kind of a notional idea about a group of people who have particular needs and will be in Cambridge for a particular amount of time and so forth. But having said all that, it's still a fun project, and it's quite a new project for us because we haven't done a lot of housing. So it's all, I always enjoy projects where we're learning something new.
So is this a very large spread
out
site?
No, the site's quite compact, but we're doing about 80 dwellings on a smallish site. So it's quite dense. Yeah.
And are they using the sort of things that you are very personally interested in, the green issues and the alternatives?
Yes, it's very high sustainability standards. Yes, yeah. So that's all very good. It's, you know, it's got PV panels generating energy. We're recycling rainwater. It's got very, very good fabric efficiency around, you know, the fabric of the building so that they don't lose heat, and very airtight, etc. So all of that, that's all very good. And that's been great working on that.
And the visual appearance.
That's interesting because we're sort of going back to look at archetypes in Cambridge and arts and crafts and so forth. So it's in a conversation with the historical fabric of Cambridge,
but not
all very
replicating it.
No, not replicating. I'm trying to make it modern, but at the same time, you know, making reference to some of that.
I mean, I live not too far away when I'm in the country to Poundbury, which is Prince Charles's toy town.
Yeah.
And I always, whenever I drive through, it always depresses me, I have to say. I mean, because I can see what he was trying to do, but just literally aping what has gone before just seems such a wasted opportunity. It seems that there are so few modern developments that really have a kind of beauty to them using modern design. I think you either get the Barrett's depressing red brick Brookside-y cul-de-sacs, which, you know, and I think, do I prefer, you know, I think, well, I prefer the Prince Charles thing to that simply because those are so miserable because I haven't seen. I think I did see something recently in the news in Harlow. I think they've developed an experimental little block, which looked interesting, a lot of light, much more kind of Dutch in their field, use of space and light, which I thought was, you know, far more interesting. More of that. Or, you know.
Although, I mean, I think there's an enormous amount of mud slung at the Prince about his sort of penchant for historical architecture. But actually, I think that we never really get into a discussion about, you know, what kinds of historicism might be relevant reference points or whether anyone's done historicism well or badly. You know, we just condemn it for being not part of the zeitgeist. But actually, I think, just to put this debate aside for one moment, I think actually the Prince's historicism is more interesting to me than, say, Barrett's or Wimpey's historicism. So, I mean, in that scale of things, I'd rather it were the Prince's stuff than anybody else's. And actually, I prefer to concentrate on issues around density, about ways of dealing with streets and car parking. And actually, that's where I think Poundbury is actually quite successful, in fact. And I think, despite the fact that it's sort of on the outskirts of quite a small county town, they seem to have managed to sort of keep land values quite high and integrate social housing in it, so they say. And I think all of that is quite good and rather seamlessly as well. So you don't get the social component sort of ghettoised and really sticking out like a sore thumb, which you do on some estates. So, you know, I think there are some really good things about Poundbury, actually, and I would defend them as an architect, but I still think, you know, there are lots of issues that need debating, and I think it's a shame that, you know, we're not debating it at a kind of higher level, really.
Mm.
But anyway, I mean, your point is taken. I mean, you're looking to always to be in conversation with a sort of historical archetype, but the key is to make it modern and to make it your own and to add something new.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to do
there. I think
there.
I agree with you. I mean, I think always learning from the past is great.
It's important.
I think the whole of Alexander's book is about that.
It is, isn't it?
It's all about that there is a timeless way of building.
Yeah, absolutely.
And don't knock it because it actually works. It works because it's been tried and tested.
Yeah, and there's just so much material to draw on as well. I mean, it's very exciting. Other things we're working on, we are working in Thamesmead at the moment, actually, doing some public realm work there, which is, again, completely opposite end of the spectrum, really. I mean, it's a very sad post-war environment, where people from the East End were moved out, and now the planning is considered not very functional.
They had a big estate.
Well, they're knocking a lot down at the moment, actually.
Many of those are being knocked down, those.
Yeah, and they're trying to sort of make it work better with better small centres and better connectivity between areas. And it's the classic Corbusian model of the city where pedestrians are split from traffic. And so it makes movement patterns very problematic and, you know, dissipates sort of footfall and density of people all over the place so that it actually you feel unsafe in the public realm and things like that. So there are lots of really important structural issues which are trying to get sorted out, and we're working with the Housing Association on that, which is for us really an exciting move. We're designing a little community building down the road in Islington for a bunch of people called Highbury Roundhouse, who run all sorts of services for the council, for from, you know, toddlers right up to the elderly, which is lovely. It's on a landlocked site quite near the Arsenal Stadium, and that's just got planning, and we're about to go into work in drawings, but they're trying to fund it at the moment, so they're trying to get us some money. We're building a little school extension in Stockport, so we're trying to keep our school building portfolio going, but that's quite difficult in the current market, especially with the government not really valuing quality school buildings at all. So I mean, it's a broad portfolio of work, and you know, trying to get work on specialist housing like self-build and co-housing and older people's housing, because that's a big growth area at the moment as well, and we're having some success in that.
So when you're not passionately involved with solving architecture problems, how do you divide, if you like, work from the everyday? Is it seamless? Do you see no difference between, you know, many designers, you know, live their life as designers and there's no division. They're just constantly thinking, problem solving, and it just merges in. Do you have a kind of break from your daily routine?
Not really.
Because I did read somewhere that you don't own a television. Is that still the case?
No, we do own a TV now, because my partner bought one for the Olympics.
Oh,
so,
right,
yeah.
Okay. Because you said that 90% of what's on television is an absolute disgrace. do you
I think I was ruder than that, actually. Well, actually, I think I've probably revised that now. I think there's some TV which is cool. I mean, I think, well, actually, probably 90% is rubbish. But of the 10% that's left, I think some of it's really good. I'm a real fan of Borgen.
You'll be delighted to hear it's back.
I know. Next series coming up. Exactly. I'm looking forward to that. I mean, there are some really good programmes on TV. But on the whole, I must say, I'm one of those people, I'm a bit fidgety. I kind of need to do things all the time. So I'm only very good in front of the television if I'm knitting or, you know, sort of half an eye on the computer or something like that, because I don't really like sitting still. But no, I like gardening. I mean, I've got a slightly obsessive compulsive personality where I do like to be busy. And so, I mean, gardening's very good. I mean, once I start, you know, it's very difficult to sort of tear me away. But I think, you know, getting out of the office is good for me, because otherwise I would be here a lot more.
Do you have in your mind a dream project you'd love to do? I say that because, for example, I heard Thomas Heatherwick on the radio a couple of years ago, and someone said to him, you know, is there a particular project you really like? And he said, I'd like to do a power station. And then within a few months, he actually got a power station to do.
He probably knew that was coming.
I don't know. But that's what he said. I just wondered whether...
No, I haven't got a dream project, but I must say I would quite like to do a bit more cultural work. I mean, we've done this dance studio for Siobhan Davies,
which is
the choreographer,
very lovely,
which I'm very proud of and which I loved to do, because it's great working with people who are very competent artists in their own right, because they can be very difficult people. They're quite, you know, they're very assured, they know their business, and they are used to directing other people. So they can be difficult collaborators, but when you get a good one, I mean, on the whole, they really care. They've got incredibly high ambitions, and, you know, and they've done it for themselves as well. So they know about how to achieve these things.
And of course, a building like that and the purpose that it's built for is very much about how a person moves in the space.
Absolutely.
I mean, so she obviously had it must have been very interesting conversation.
That was a fantastic synergy for us, because, you know, we're interested in space, light, movement, etc. she's interested in that as well, and so there was an enormous amount of synergy between
us. So did you learn from her?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, we learned ways of working with her as well, because believe it or not, she found drawings very difficult to read, and she didn't understand scale very well. I mean, for somebody who obviously measures space through the body, the idea of working in dull drawings that are miniature scale, you know, just didn't mean anything. So there was a lot of sort of arm waving, pacing around, you know, going to look at things, you know, talking, arms waving all over the place. And that was really interesting for us. You know, we had to find other ways of communicating. We did a lot through models, a lot of visiting, a lot of pacing around. You know, it was really interesting, very challenging. Mm. But that's what's so lovely, because you learn things about your own craft when you're working with other people in different disciplines. Mm. So, you know, collaborating with others in other disciplines is fantastic. Love to do that.
Now, always at the end of these interviews, I'm interested to know what sort of advice you would give to young budding students. So you've already mentioned, you know, your teaching. So I think if you've got just a couple of gems that you might want to just... for anyone listening
difficult.
And that want to follow in your footsteps.
Well, I suppose three things. I mean, I think you've got to find out, and it's a voyage of discovery. It'll take a long time, 15 years maybe, what kind of a designer you are. You know, what is it that really turns you on to this business? Because it's a hard slog. It's quite grueling. And, you know, if you don't want to wake up in the morning and get up and do it, then you should get into another business. You know, so you have to find the thing that really switches you on. And that's a voyage of self-discovery. Then I think you need enormous resilience and sort of persistence, really, as well. So you cannot give up at the first sort of stumbling block. You've got to keep going, and you've got to believe in it and have a real vision in what you're trying to achieve in order to sort of see it through. And don't let other people deflect you. You know, just don't.
Well, I think it's clear that you're going to carry on. That's for sure. Sarah Wigglesworth, thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.